This is a car show, but it's also more, because cars connect us to every part of our lives.
Families, careers, hobbies, and adventures we never expected. So you should have a car you love. And we're here to help. I'm Todd.
I'm Paul. And this is the Everyday Driver Car Debate.
Happy Tuesday, everybody. We are back with another Crazy Topic Tuesday. You guys, we've asked, and you guys are sending in amazing ones. And this one was coming in from longtime listener Hal. And he sent in, on first blush, is a really innocuous topic Tuesday. And then I sat down to try to make lists, and there was research, and there was head scratching, and I'm sure I've gotten a lot of it wrong. But this is a fascinating topic Tuesday. We'll probably end up blowing away the entire hour on this topic and maybe get to some questions. The question is, most influential vehicle of each decade. I will say right now, I did not do one. I just made lists.
I made lists. It's so innocuous because it's so open-ended.
Yes.
Just name the most influential vehicle of each decade.
It
and
goes,
you think, how easy?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay,
there's probably just one or two, maybe two.
It goes
right?
For a century, the 1920s to the 2020s. And I am going to say right now, by the way, that I don't have an answer for the 2020s because we've barely started. I mean, I could debate.
I have ideas.
But I'm glad. We are going to start with the 1920s. I've got probably a half dozen. And then as we get closer to cars you and I have driven, the lists get longer. But I have reasons for my choices, but I am going to start with, I think, 1920s. There's other influential ones.
We could have started in the 10s.
Yeah,
things were still just 20s. A shell on a chassis.
There's a lot of cars out there by the 20s, and they range a lot. And you'll see how most of the rest of the ones on my list here do not match the first one. But I will say the 1920s is the Model T. Introduced a decade earlier, but it is the definitive car. It is the first people's car. It is the first car you see everywhere. It is the first thing with lots of variations. It's just, that's what a car looks like, is the Model T in the 1920s. We can spin off into what I would consider the exotics of the 1920s, and I'll bring up some of those. But if I had to go first, it was just Model T.
You're absolutely right. I did spin off into the exotics.
I did too.
Starting with Gabriel Voisin's cars. He exhibited a V12 as early as 1921, and Gabriel Voisin's engineering came from aircraft inspiration and the use of light alloy. There are famous photos of a guy named Rudolph Valentino in his 1924 Voisin C5 Tourer. He was the famous Italian actor who died at age 31 in 1926, and he was seen in Voisin's cars.
Interesting.
He was doing things his own way. Voisin was. I was trying to look at each decade and trying to find the through line of each decade here. For the 20s, the 1920s, it was people find themselves, you're absolutely right, with the Model T. And then upon that, everybody looked at that and said, okay, car. What's my vision of that? And I moved on to the 1929 Bugatti Type 35 that had a straight 8 engine that dictated the design. The reason this is on my list is because I did see one when I was still living in Los Angeles, and I decided to go to a Sotheby's auction. They were selling a 29 Type 35, but they had it in Beverly Hills at their Sotheby's auction office in the back. The auction was slated elsewhere.
Iconic blue one with the the race car.
I mean, many of them were blue.
Yeah, but I'm just with the outboard wheels and
Correct.
What I'm envisioning. Got it.
That left such a huge impression on me because they fired it up in the parking lot. I mean, as car idiots do. I mean, they're this you know, hoity-toity auction house. We're slick and smooth and you can't afford us. And then everybody went out back because they said, oh, it's actually here. And it was a preview of the upcoming auction, which was not going to be held in Beverly Hills. And of course, everybody went out back and suddenly all pretense just disappeared. We were suddenly just car nerds. Men and women, everybody was just like geeked out about this thing. And they fired it up and hearing a straight eight engine, the mechanical noises of a straight eight. And then you had your external brake. You shifted and adjusted the spark and everything was so mechanical. And they raced it up and down the back alley in Beverly Hills. They were like, well, we got to see it move. And so one of the auctioneers was like, I know how to drive it. And they were driving in the back alley in Beverly Hills, geeking out and being idiots.
That's amazing.
It's like a straight eight engine blasting by with terrible brakes. It's like,
but
that's
the thing, is that straight eights are iconic in this 20s era. This is honestly one of the few times on this podcast that I really feel like we're doing it a disservice by not having it be a video. Most time you're looking at us if you do a video, and that's fine, and we enjoy that. But
to show each of these
I just
things,
almost wish we could pull up every single model and show it to you because straight eights are key in the 20s. The Duesenberg Model J is pretty much...
Thank you,
that's,
yes.
When you think of, like, in your head, or you know what? Ask AI. They'll build it. When you think of, show me a speakeasy and some very nice dressed people from the 20s going out for a night in their really nice car, it looks kind of like what this Duesenberg Model J looks like. So that's on there. Auburn, a company you've never even heard of, probably. They have the Boattail Speedster.
Yes.
Straight 8. But the interesting thing there is, technically, a 3-speed. However... A 2-speed rear axle means it's actually a 6-speed because you have 2 rear axle ratios and you have 3 gears. So it's a 6-speed straight 8 from the 20s. I have 2 others. One is the Blower Bentley because nothing in the world says you're serious like I'm leading with the supercharger. It's out in front of the bumper. It's just supercharger followed by car. Okay. Nothing says those get out of my way like that. And then the last one is a car I've actually seen at the, and I'm not going to get the name right. It's at the Peterson in LA. It's the round door Rolls Royce Phantom.
Oh, wait, wasn't that a Bugatti or was that?
No, there's a Bugatti. There's a Bugatti with a round. But there's a big black round door Rolls Royce Phantom coupe thing from the 20s that has some other ridiculous name that I can't begin to pronounce.
Let's try that.
That is just spectacular. You're thinking of a Bugatti that I actually have on my list.
Okay.
But there is a round door black Rolls Royce Phantom coupe that is just like, what is that?
The Blower Bentleys always suggested to me as the second car ever built. It's like,
it seems like,
why was the second car
ever
built?
We made a Model
built?
T and then I have to beat you.
Exactly.
So supercharger before bumper.
Exactly. Yes. To be faster than the first car ever built, which felt like the Model T. But you're right. For the late 20s, I had Fred Duesenberg's cars on here because to me that defined the stark contrast of rich and poor during the Great Depression.
Absolutely.
It's the Duesenberg that signified that entire era at the end of the 20s and the Great Depression.
Yep.
I associate the Depression with Duesenbergs.
Yes,
weirdly.
Absolutely. And you're right. It's like Duesenberg driving down the road in New York next to a Model T, and you just go like, the family with the Model T is actually wealthy compared to most.
Correct.
And then you got Duesenberg behind him that's like from another planet.
Yes.
It's and crazy. Yeah.
The calculation now for the dollar. And
sure.
They were
yeah.
astronomically wealthy. Some more than Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, crazy stuff. Yeah.
All right, moving on to the 1930s. I had Packards and Cadillacs in this era because that really did define, and of course, Duesenberg's continued. But there was a single car for me for the 30s, and that is the Volkswagen Beetle.
Interesting. Yeah, I have it listed because it does go on until the early 2000s. A car from
forever.
The 30s went on for 70 years.
Just the Volkswagen Beetle and just the thinking. It was so iconic and influential on everything. I mean, the Porsche Model 64 was derived from the Beetle, which I don't love to admit, but it was.
Yeah, yeah.
The 356, actually. The 718 had derivations from
Volkswagen
Beetle, and then they continued and modified and built their own brand. But still, the Beetle.
That's excellent.
It.
I've got a couple others. That's definitely on my list. Got a couple others. First off, I want to bring up the existence of the Cadillac V16.
Yeah.
Made in lots of different coachworks. That was when Cadillac was doing coachwork stuff. So you see him, if you look it up, you can see him in lots of different body styles. But fundamentally, this is a V16 launched on the back of the Great Depression.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Cadillac lost money on every single one of them.
Oh my
now, gosh. That is the extreme contrast to your point of the Beetle, which is that just goes on for 70 years. The V16 was like, oops. So anyway, so the Cadillac V16.
Yeah.
There was the BMW 328 Roadster. Okay. It looks like kind of like the Bugatti you mentioned in the 20s. It has that kind of bicycle wheel, external fenders,
like
really narrow
fender.
Body kind of idea.
Yeah.
But first off, it was a Mille Miglia winner.
Ah.
It has the tall nostril BMW grills.
The vertical, slender grills, which BMW points to as an excuse to do their current design.
But it keep in mind, the BMW 328, that is embedding that iconic number plate for BMW into the 30s.
That's good.
So that one's out there. The Bugatti Type 57 is the Atlantic, is the one you're probably thinking of when I mentioned the Rolls.
I think it's the Atlantic.
That's the one that Ralph Lauren has one. It's the big scooped, almost it's like almost like a dress, like laid over the fenders.
Yeah.
The wheels are actually like canted out. It has the very rearward cabin. One of the most spectacular looking cars ever for me is the Bugatti Type 57 Atlantic. Amazing. And the last one, the Ford Deluxe. Think of the ZZ Top car, how it came off the assembly line. That's what the ZZ Top car, or like the old Ford hot rods, they were essentially built from the Ford Deluxe of the 30s. That's the core of what that car is. And so when I actually think about and I bump into that, I'm like, well, yeah, there's the 30s right there in a car. This is the step beyond the look of the Model T that you're all thinking of, the big fendered thing that became hot rods is the Ford Deluxe.
Well, you're right. Every T-bucket hot rod, every hot rod derivation from here on out, I mean, the Prowler looks back.
Yes, know? Absolutely. Prowler,
that looked back to the 30s. Mm-hmm. That was the Chip Foose kind of ripoff design that Chrysler did because that was his project for Art Center. Anyway,
Chip Foose is a man whose name is an iconic brand.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive. Yeah, for sure. You don't realize how much of an influence, I mean, he's a great designer, how much of an influence Chip Foose has had until you go to an event that he happens to be there, and nowhere near where he is, there is the Foose trailer. The Foose trailer.
Foose trailer.
Yeah, sorry. The Foose trailer.
I foosed it.
I foosed it. I'm going to go foose something.
What happened to your trailer? I foosed it.
There's the Foose trailer over there with his branding on it and a line of people just buying Foose gear. And you'll see people.
They were getting a Foose.
Seriously. You foosed something on him. You see people walking around SEMA and they just have his name on their chest. I'm just like,
yeah.
That's
weird.
And there's no design. It's just his name.
He had that early, like in his 20s, early 30s, because I had him as an instructor for my eighth term, and such a nice guy. But every car, it was a Chrysler-sponsored project, and he would go around the room and, you know, give individual instruction, but he was working for Boyd Cotting at the time.
Yeah.
And he went around and added little hot rod touches to everybody's senior project. So everybody's car was like cool futuristic sedan with French doors or a little hot rod touch here. It's like, oh, Chip has been here. Like, it wasn't a bad thing. And he added a lot to the design, but it was subtle things.
That's very funny. I love it.
It was really cool. All right. 1940s. Mm-hmm. Of course, World War II really hampered a lot of things.
All of the good stuff from the 40s is from the late 40s.
It's the late 40s,
Look at history and you understand why. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I have two on my list. Okay. And I'm going to start with the 1948 Citroën de Chavu. And you remember the famous basket of eggs suspension demonstration that car accomplished because the French roads were so terrible and they had innovative engineering for such a low price. And that little car, there's no shape like it. That is French cars to this day. That's just French cars in a sketch. Mm. And it's the easiest shapes. They're friendly. And what a car. I mean, I think it was Chris Harris that did the basket of eggs.
Oh, yeah, for
sure. The reconstruction. Uh-huh. Yep. He did the whole video, and it was true. It was, I mean, very few, I think if any, were broken. And it was because they used innovation in that car. And this decade really is devoted to innovation because the second one I have is the 1949 Tucker sedan.
I have the Tucker as well.
Preston Tucker's 122 mile per hour dream car was designed with the help of Alex Tremulous. It was powered by a rear mounted Franklin Flat 6 helicopter engine converted to a sealed system with water cooling. It had disc brakes, a pop out windscreen, a padded dash, independent suspension, and a very cool center headlight.
Mm-hmm. That actually turned with the steering wheel. Preston Tucker is Elon Musk, but he failed. It's somebody that comes into cars with totally different perspective and wants to do now. And I'll even go one further. I think Tucker had more of the original ideas himself than Elon did when he first came into Tesla. Elon was an investor in Tesla and pushed him forward.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Preston Tucker is the guy that comes in and is trying to fight the big automakers and can't. But he has all of these "why would you do that" ideas that we look back on now and go, it took decades for other brands to come up with some of those things and execute them. And he was moonshotting in the 40s.
I just realized both Preston Tucker and Elon Musk have run into trouble with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yes, similar. See,
both of them had trouble with the SEC.
I'm telling you, yes.
Holy cow. Well, this thing had the 4-speed manual. Some had the Tuckermatic transmission built in a former Dodge aircraft plant in Chicago. And ultimately, he was exonerated. Preston Tucker was. And, you know, Elon Musk has wriggled out of things, too.
But the cars didn't survive. I mean, if that brand had gone on, and of course there wasn't like venture capital investing at the time, if that had gone on and survived, what would have happened to the automotive industry and what would have happened to Tucker cars? It's very interesting to me.
If any manufacturer is going to introduce a center headlight, I know that modern technology obviates the need for it.
It's unnecessary now, but yeah.
But I wonder if something in the future is going to look back and go, you know, what about headlights across the front? What about just different lighting? Because it's always now just two, one on each side.
Yeah, pretty interesting. That's a great one. I really do like that. I have the Buick Roadmaster. This is the Rain
Love
Man
it.
Car.
Love it.
That is so indicative of the 40s. The large hood that then has slightly less high, large fenders. That is such the look of the 40s. And the Buick Roadmaster just nailed that. The DeSoto S10 is a sub-brand of Chrysler. They did a variant of it as well. And this was the one that was the family car of the time and became the taxi cabs. From the 40s to the early 50s was typically the DeSoto S10s. Mm. They look a lot like the Buick Roadmaster, even though the Roadmaster, up to its name, was classier. But if you've ever seen the movie Rain Man, Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman, the car that Dustin Hoffman drives every week is an old convertible Buick Roadmaster. And it is such a car of the time. Another one I have on my list is the Jaguar XK120.
Classic, beautiful, yes.
It amazes me every time I realize that's a car from the 1940s. But this is a car that, if you think about it, American GIs were buying and driving in Europe.
Yes.
And coming back to the U.S. and inspired, as cars coming up, inspired things like the Corvette and the Thunderbird, because nothing in the U.S., the U.S. was making the Buick Roadmaster. And England is making the XK120, which if you've ever stood by one, is tiny.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, they're small.
But it was this cool wave-shaped roadster. They had it for a long time in every variant you can imagine. At the time, it was briefly the fastest car in the world, and it's really little, and it's entirely open-topped. But that is indicative not only of the impression that Jaguar makes and hangs on to for a long time, but also the ripples that it makes through other people's perception of what a small, fun sports car should be.
That's really excellent. Spring cleaning is here. That means it's time to take that summer or performance car out of the garage and get it ready for driving season with upgraded brakes. PowerStop's Z26 Street Warrior Brake Upgrade Kit features drilled and slotted rotors that will keep your brake temperatures low while resisting rust. Included in that kit are carbon fiber ceramic pads that will give you durable, reliable stopping power without all that nasty brake dust.
Head to PowerStop.com and fill in your vehicle's information into their easy-to-use brake finder to find complete kits and components for your car. Join us and thousands of other drivers that have already transformed their vehicles into a stopping powerhouse. PowerStop is brake upgrades made easy.
All right, we're moving on to the 50s. There are a lot of cars, actually.
My lists keep getting longer. Every decade, I'm having to pare it down as we go. Yeah.
I know that there's just one or two for the 50s because there was so much going on. And I'll start with the 1953 Chevy Corvette, as you talked about, inspiration from all the European cars GIs were buying. And inspired by that and rockets. If you look at those tail fins, tiny tail fins.
Yeah, watch our American original rockets film. We talk about it at length and we show off the first. We have one of the cars built within the first 6 months of the Corvette program. And the rocket influence is kind of overwhelming.
It was the rocket age.
Yes,
that was
absolutely.
The whole point. And the next one on my list is the 1956 Mercedes-Benz 300 SL Gullwing.
Yes,
iconic.
I've got that too. Yes.
I mean, a race car with gullwing doors. Fascinating.
And I also think that's one of those cars that is so iconic, you forget when it's from.
True.
When I say 1950s, I kind of have to like look it up again and be like, really?
Yeah.
The 50s?
Yeah, back when Mercedes was really known for straight sixes too. What a stake in the ground. All right, moving on to the 1959 Cadillac Series 62, the height of the tail fin cars.
Yeah.
Post-war enthusiasm and look to the future and everything's going to be grand and no problems and it's roses from here on out, right?
The Coupe de Ville with fins you could hurt yourself on. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, the Thunderbird's got to be in there. Yep. The Thunderbird is classic.
Absolutely,
classic design. What still amazes me with everything we're talking about, all these cars still use steel, aluminum, alloys, leather, metal, wood, all these
fair points.
Same materials. Yeah. How can they be so different and have such different character and different driving character? That's just continually astounding to me. I played around with the Chevy Nomad. I was thinking about the 57 Chevy and then, well, the 58 Cadillac I really love because it had that stainless top, the stainless roof on it. I'm inspired by that. Just different materials. You know, here's the Cybertruck using stainless now. So
sure, yeah.
Stuff has been tried, but there's many from the 50s.
You've mentioned some great ones. I'm going to add a few. Keep in mind that the 1950s introduces us to the Ford 100 series pickup.
That's true. Good, yes.
It starts there. And at that point, it has this weird rounded nose. It doesn't look like it's going to become this big boxy truck. It's very rounded when it first starts. So the Ford 100 series pickup, you mentioned the Vette and the Thunderbird. Those are excellent. The Chevrolet Bel Air, that is the classic two-tone 50s car you're imagining.
Yeah.
I know what you're doing right now. You're imagining it in blue with white.
Yes.
You all are. That is the car. That is the Chevrolet Bel Air. There it is. Citroen DS started in 1955.
Awesome choice.
That does not seem like a car from 55. They made it for 20 years. Self-leveling, power steering, four-wheel disc brakes, turning headlights, crazy space, completely unique style that maintains and seems futuristic when they stop selling it 20 years later. The DS is madness.
Good. I like that.
Two others that I don't think come from this era. The Lotus 7 is from the 50s. That's what a Caterham is now. It starts in the 50s.
That's true.
You can go buy a new Caterham right now, and that is the design from the 50s. What are we doing? Another one that's crazy to me that I love from this era is the original Mini.
Oh, good.
1957, the first time anyone had ever, think about it, we were talking straight eights, we're talking V16s, we're talking flat sixes. The engineer behind the Mini took a four-cylinder and turned it transverse. It had never been done in a passenger car. And he created that tiny little shape that could get, not well, four adults in it. Because it was a
four
transverse.
Four unhappy adults.
But think about it. The transverse mounted front wheel drive vehicle that creates nothing but space behind your ankles for the rest of the car. It's just, as you've pointed out, the back wheels are just there like shopping cart wheels holding the back up, keep it from scraping.
They hold the back
Seriously.
Of the car off the ground.
But 1957, the original Mini. And think about how that change is so iconic all the way up to right now. You can go buy yourself a five-seat, five-door CUV with a transversely mounted four-cylinder that creates space behind it. That owes its whole existence and concept to the Mini in 1957.
I know that we will be missing some cars. I'm positive that everyone,
yes.
Every one of you listening is thinking of something that we didn't say. But again, we have to stick with influential. The list could be, we could go forever, right?
Well, and what's your definition of influential? I mean, that's the other part of it. The fun part of all these car debates is that you guys are yelling at your listening device, and we welcome that. And when you see us in person at one of our adventures, by the way, still room on the Utah Adventure, the Beartooth Highway piece that I'm very excited about that we're going to do late summer, that is about to be open for registration. So stand by on that. There's still space to go to Germany and Spa in October with us via Hooked on Driving. So you can look that up right now, hookedondriving.com. It's right there on the homepage. There's still space to go there as well. You can tell us in person how we got this list wrong. I'm telling you. It's a side note.
I love it. All right. So the 1960s, the top of my list is the 1961 Jaguar E-Type Series 1. That is at the very top because, wow. Again, yeah. We're still using all the same materials that everyone prior, for decades prior, they've all used those same materials too. How can you create such rolling sculpture?
And 60 years later, Jaguar is still trading on the icon of that car.
And probably always will.
Probably always will, yes. They're still trading on, like.
What else do they have in their portfolio currently that is inspiring?
But isn't nothing. But isn't that crazy that they are still trading on that? And along those lines, actually, here's a car that also is from that era that they're still trading on. The Aston Martin DB5, the James Bond car.
That's good.
Is still, anytime Aston Martin reveals anything new, there's a DB5 there.
That's true.
Anytime Jaguar releases anything new, they bring out the E-Type. I can't think of any other brands that are still doing that, where every time they release a new whatever, they bring out this one you really do love.
Mm.
The E-Type for Jaguar and the DB5, the original James Bond classic for Aston Martin. And I'm not taking away from either of those cars. I just think this is how completely embedded in the DNA of those companies these two cars are.
That's a great way of putting it. I was noticing the through line here, and that is cars that will always influence everything that manufacturer does for the rest of time, for eternity.
Yep.
The E-Type, the 1963 Porsche 911.
Yes, absolutely.
Designed by F.A. Porsche, son of the founder Ferry Porsche, unveiled on September 12th, 1963 at the Frankfurt International Motor Show. In 60 now years of the 911, over 1.2 million 911s have been built.
originally shown at that auto show as the Porsche 901 and Peugeot. Excuse me.
You're going to have to change that. So they changed it to the 911. And I can't believe it's been a decade since we filmed the 50 years in the 911.
Craziness, isn't it?
60 years of that car.
Yep.
Jaguar has the E-Type. And we'll always have the E-Type reference.
Yeah.
Aston has the DB5. Mm-hmm. We'll always have that. Somewhere embedded in the styling. Of course, the 911.
Yep,
and absolutely. Then the 1964 Ford Mustang. There will always be some Mustang. They came out with a Mustang. Everybody's like, okay, that will be the car for the rest of eternity for Ford. You'll never, ever stop making Mustangs,
I think it's interesting, though, that that is the second time that Ford does an overwhelming everyman car success. There's the Model T up front.
Good point.
And they're back in the 60s with the Mustang that revolutionized. I mean, the pony cars and muscle cars follow the Mustang. That whole world springs from the Mustang's existence. Mm-hmm. Okay? So cars, if you will, the mass cars spring from the Model T. And then Ford does it again here with the Mustang. Who knew the Mustang would be this much? Also, who knew that the Mustang would be inspiring other car makers to make their version?
I like that also... 1969 seemed to me, I mean, it's a year for many things, but that seemed to be like the 60s version of that moment in time definition.
So much good stuff in 69.
You know
right.
what I mean? Yeah, like yeah, totally. The Camaro. Well, just the 69 Camaro, because of course.
The 69 Dodge Charger becomes the General Lee.
Exactly right.
There's so much good stuff then. Yeah.
GTOs,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Everything from the 60s era. So everybody will have their thing. We're missing cars in there, I know, but it's got to be super iconic.
Alfa Romeo Spider.
Oh,
featured in The Graduate. That's from the 60s.
Yes.
The Lincoln Continental suicide door, four-door convertible, I hate to say it, made infamous by John F. Kennedy. But prior to that, who else was making that? And since that, who else has made that? And then all the way up to the HBO show Entourage, where that's what they were driving around in, all four guys.
That's right.
We have this question come up on the podcast every now and then where you guys say, okay, we are a family of four and we need a convertible. And we say, ooh, that's going to be tough.
How about a 1962 Continental?
But the Lincoln Continental... did it with space and class. And Lincoln has, I will say it, Lincoln has never come back to that height.
Bit of body roll in the corners.
But, not the reason you buy it.
Exactly.
And the other one that I have to mention from the 60s, because who knew it would go the places it would go? The Volkswagen Type 2 van. The VW van.
It's great.
That's out of the 60s. Isn't it always in the 60s? You see that car right now in 2024 and you think, is it 1965 in here? What's going on? Is it 60? Are we going to Woodstock? That's all that van says.
Well, it's associated with so many things. You see a van and half of you will go, dude.
Oh, we're all talking flower power jokes. Here we are. Yep.
The 1970s belongs to Italian designers, in my opinion, and the anything goes approach to cars. Because in 1974, Marcello Gandini of the Bertone Studio introduced the Lamborghini Countach, the 74 Countach. Fantastic scissor doors, icon of all supercars from here on out.
I'll go you one further. Did Gandini influence an entire generation or two of car lovers as to what a good car looks like? Because he does the Miura, the Countach, and the Lancia Stratos all in this decade. He does all three.
Amazing.
And if you talk to random child that is now an adult, what was the way you drew a car as a kid? I mean, except for you, Paul, because you were beyond us. It was just a wedge shape.
Right.
It was a wedge.
Yeah.
We just drew wedges.
But it was a pretty wedge.
But the point I'm making is, how influential was he that in the 1970s, these are his three cars, Miura, Countach, and Lancia Stratos, and we all just sit around drawing wedges forevermore.
That just means fast, supercar, the most desirable object ever was sketched by Gandini. The Countach. And the Countach lasted for a long time, as you know, but it was 74 when it came out. But there's another Italian designer from that decade who designed the 1974 Volkswagen Golf, the first Mark I generation that became the definition of what a hot hatch is.
Yep.
That's Giorgetto Giugiaro.
Very good.
Design
Excellent.
Studio. Yep. The Golf, it was angular and still kind of wedgish, but that is what everybody associates with now, hot hatches and fun, accessible performance driving.
That's very good. I like that a lot. I've got a few others. One is the Pinto. It's an icon from the 70s. Okay?
Is it a good icon?
But think about this, though. It's not a good icon, but it is a instant reference for the gas crisis era, as is the Mustang,
True.
Too, but the Pinto even more so. But it also is the car that everybody points to as we are concerned about making cars safer. We all think Pinto and we think gas tank in the rear, tap it in the rear and it blows up. Okay. But this is one of the cars, and there were others. This is one of the cars that started to change the public consciousness to not just, hey, that car's cool, but are we concerned about safety at all?
So
the Pinto actually kind of pivots the conversation that way. I have a few others. The Datsun 510 sedan is from this era.
Ah.
This is the beginning. We think of, at least I do, we think of the Japanese invasion of cars is the 80s, but it's the 70s. The Datsun 510 is out there. The Honda Civic shows up. Nissan 240Z, the everyman's version of the E-Type from the decade prior. These are all from the 70s. And while I'm here, how about a BMW 2002? Dropping onto the market in the 1970s and showing you what a small, agile, and still usable sedan can be. These are 1970s icons here.
That's really good. As I'm thinking about your descriptions, we could have said Corvair for the 60s, but influential? Yes, from a safety standpoint, I suppose, but we could have included that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll keep going with my 70s list. I've got two
There's
more.
So many others, yeah.
I went race cars here.
Okay, good. I like
because
it.
Because I put the 1973 Porsche 917/30 Can-Am car.
Okay.
Porsche turbocharged the flat 12 from the 917 to make 1,300 horsepower, which was the most powerful sports car ever built and raced.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty much banned through the imposition of fuel consumption rules by the sanctioning bodies, SCCA. The hottest racing cars nowadays are not 1,300 horsepower. We think of supercars like, oh, and EVs, 1,300 horsepower. Oh, nobody's ever done 1,300 horsepower. Well, actually in 73, Porsche did.
Yeah.
And it was freaking scary to drive. I mean, that was the real drivers.
You never hear anybody talk about the 917. Like, yeah, it was docile. It was just easy. No one says that. All the guys that drove them hard are just like, well, that was trying to kill me. All of them are like that. Anyway.
The other one was the fan car.
That's very good. I like that. Yes.
Seen the fan car run at Laguna Seca at the Monterey Historics. This is the 1970 Chaparral 2J, the one that used a Rockwell JLO 247cc two-stroke dual-cylinder 45 horsepower engine, the kind that's found in snowmobiles.
Mm-hmm.
Powered two rear fans from the M109 howitzer tank to suck the car to the ground and create massive downforce, independent of the 7-liter Chevy ZL1 V8 making 650 horsepower.
Mm.
This is an early example of ground effects, but the thing weighed 1,800 pounds and created 2,200 pounds of downforce.
And was quickly banned for being too good. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's craziness. Yeah.
Because of the sucking power of the turbines, the car would creep forward on its own between 24 and 40 miles per hour, which meant the driver, of course, had to have their foot on the brake during startup. But the biggest thing is those rear fans pulled air from underneath the car along with anything else like rocks and dust and debris and grass clippings and threw it out the back at the person behind you. So not only is it faster, it throws all the crap on the track.
I'm passing you and I'm throwing stuff at you just to really enforce the point.
Just to really insult you.
That is amazing. I do love it. The thing I think is interesting is I started looking into the 70s. I realized a couple things. And we started with Gandini. I'm going to continue with some other things that are along the same headspace. I love those are such good cars.
Blast you with all the crap on the track.
That's so amazing.
Sucker.
The thing about the 70s is, I think we all look at the 70s as nothing good came out of the 70s car-wise. But what I'm realizing is in the 70s, there are big moonshot things, Countach being an obvious one, but there are moonshot things that inform all the decades to come. And we don't think they come from the 70s. Let me give you a couple others. The Mercedes SL convertible, 70s.
That's right.
The car that every non-American thinks an American in the South drives is the Cadillac Eldorado convertible, the Boss Hog car.
Oh my gosh.
With the horns on the hood. That's the 1970s.
That's
and
right.
I guarantee you, if you've ever met anybody from overseas who's never been to the U.S. and hears the word Cadillac, they are thinking of that car.
100%.
So there's that.
That's fantastic.
I couldn't resist.
I love that.
The Corvette Stingray is the king of Coke bottle styling. Every automaker tried Coke bottle styling. The Corvette Stingray of the 70s, that's just it. That's a 1970s Coke bottle styling. Done. And the last one that's probably going to surprise you, Paul, because you're, well, actually two more. Before I get to the last one, I'll surprise you. Ferrari Daytona.
Ooh.
That just pretty much is Ferrari walking around the world going, you want a front-mounted, classy GT car V12? By the way, stop writing. We've finished. We're done. We've done it.
Mike.
This is just, this is how we do this. And the rest of you just sit down for a bit.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. But you're the one that I think is going to surprise you is the Porsche 928. And I'm putting it here, not just because it came out in the 70s, because historically, this is Porsche finding itself. Mm. If you think about it, they made the 928 to kill the 911.
True.
And then realized that their audience wanted the 911 to continue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think without the 928, which is totally different than the 911, and I know you have love for it, and there's many amazing things about it, and it lasts for nearly 20 years on its own.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But without the 928 going a completely different route, would Porsche have gone, you know what? What we do is 911 and variations off of that idea. Mm. It is the side strike, if you will, because there was the 944, and Porsche was shifting what they did.
True.
But the 928 showing up to kill the 911 is what made Porsche go, who are we?
And they were trying to make automotive perfection, the pinnacle of what
Porsche engineering
could demonstrate was manifested in the 928. Now, that meant for very expensive upkeep and maintenance, but still.
Really? Was it expensive, Paul?
Yeah. Still is.
But I also,
40 years later.
But I also never think of that car as the 1970s, and it is.
Whatever car you're looking for, and wherever it's listed, you'll find it with AutoTempest.com. AutoTempest.com brings together results from all the top used car listing sites online to save you time and help you find the perfect car. It even lets you compare with nationwide results from Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist, not just your local area.
Plus, you can now get email alerts for your search, so you're sure to never miss a thing. You can even price and find new cars from nearby dealers. That's why AutoTempest is now the official sponsor of all of our test drive videos. We use it to search for new cars or used cars wherever they are.
When you're doing your drive homework, you're chasing the next family car, or just browsing so you can see what's available, go to AutoTempest.com/everyday so they know we sent you. AutoTempest. All the cars. One search. All right, the 1980s, in my opinion, belongs to exploration.
Okay.
Starting out with, again, a design from Giorgetto Giugiaro at Ital Design. Mm. He is the same famous designer. He's still alive who designs Vredestein tires. The 1983 DMC DeLorean.
You've got to. You have to. Pretty much if you say, what's a car from the 1980s, everybody's thinking of whatever one they want to mention after the DeLorean.
Exactly.
We all just understand DeLorean, 1980s. Moving on.
The Ferrari Testarossa from 1986 is on my list, designed by Pininfarina. Also the 87 Porsche 959, all the technology they could muster and set the tone for all future Porsche supercars. And I also have on my list the 1985 Audi Sport Quattro because of Group B racing and how dominant that thing was. That set the name Quattro, the hallowed name Quattro, in everybody's minds, to me, is manifested in the 85 Audi Sport Quattro.
This is what we were talking about for Aston and Jag and that kind of stuff. This Audi Quattro is the thing that the brand is still trading on decades later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if they really want to talk about, we made a performance all-wheel drive at Audi, somewhere in the warehouse is the Quattro under lights. This is how they use it.
With a spotlight.
Absolutely. This is how they do it. Right. Keep going.
Right. That's my list for now. I'm on that list for now.
1980s is the BMW M3. The E30 M3 shows up in the 80s.
Okay, good. I've got an M3 elsewhere on my list.
Buick Grand National shows up. And I bring that up because America, who has been doing, what's the biggest engine we can make, goes, what if we make it smaller and turbo it? Everybody else is doing it.
Talk about a car that is only built to sit and get auctioned off.
Yes.
That's the whole purpose of the Grand National, the GNXs.
When they were being sold new, they were somewhat cool and interesting because they were like surprisingly fast, and it's a turbo car from Buick and all this kind of stuff. Now it's just like, have you seen mine wrapped in plastic? I'm auctioning it to a new guy next year. That's how that happens,
exactly.
For sure. Peugeot has the 205 GTI.
Oh,
that
good.
Is a beloved hot hatch from the 1980s. True. You mentioned the 959, but the same year was the Ferrari F40, which is crazy.
That's true.
And earlier in the 80s was the 288 GTO, which candidly I kind of lust after more than the F40. That's the super hot version, if you want to think of it, of the Ferrari 308 chassis. And I just think the 288 GTO is so spectacular to look at. The Toyota MR2 shows up.
Oh, that's good.
In the 80s.
Okay. All right.
The Lancia Delta Integrale, also the 80s. How did these rally cars of the 80s just live on in all of our brains?
Renault R5 Turbo,
Yes, this is what I'm saying. All of these
everybody
cars
just live wants on. That
isn't
car.
That crazy? The very first Acura Integra, it's not the one that is beloved, but it first shows up in the late 80s.
That's
I knew a guy
point.
In yeah. high school that had one, a car you love, the Mercedes AMG Hammer.
Oh, dang, yes.
It's the Mercedes Porsche co-branding there. That is a fascinating car. Also a car that lives on indefinitely in all of our minds. The Mustang Fox Body is a 1980s car.
That's true. Fox Body.
Are you hearing Vanilla Ice right now, or is it just me? Okay, rolling Shall in I? The 5.0. Anyway, moving
oh
on.
Gosh.
With the top pulled down so my hair can blow. Moving on. Honda CRX is from the 80s.
Oh, that's true.
That is almost peak Honda.
Sweet.
It's a tiny, tiny little thing, incredibly chuckable and wonderful. A car I know you love to hate, but I have to bring it up because it may be the only car I can think of that actually executed this when sold to the public. The Nissan Pulsar with a modular back end.
I love to hate that car.
I know you do, but you could make it a coupe, you could make it a hatch. You just take off one back and you put a different back on. It's a modular car they sold to the public.
See,
what
everyone,
is going
this,
on
this
there?
Is why I tell you, I don't want a reversible belt. I don't want a car that changes.
I
it
know.
Doesn't change as you grow. Buy it as a sports car and then your kids grow into the car when they turn 16. No, no, no.
I remember, no. I remember going to the presentations when you were at Art Center. And seeing what other people were showing.
And, looks good on the wall as a sketch, doesn't it?
And there were multiple people that were doing modular cars.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
It's always a thing. The other thing that's always a thing, by the way, it's been around for a long time, and I haven't been paying attention to design nearly as long as Paul, is the autonomous car with seats that swivel and it becomes a living room.
Yay.
That was happening a lot in the 90s when, you were, when
fun,
you were there
everyone.
As well. Yeah, it's craziness. But no, the Pulsar was an actual modular car that was sold to the public.
They did. You don't see those things anymore.
You don't. Here's the thing. If you do, take photos because that is that that rarely ever happens.
Riddance.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But see, the reason that executives as car at car companies look at student work with the modular thing, mm-hmm. they think it shows creative thinking. Mm-hmm. That's what they're not interested in the actual design of whatever the sketch is manifested. They're looking for the thinking behind the subject, the sketch process that got you to the final result. And they'll many times point out a small sketch that's just a quick idea over here, and they'll say, well, why didn't you develop that? That's an interesting idea because it shows you're thinking over here.
Interesting.
And you
okay.
went a different direction. It manifested in itself in this ugly, weird thing, but okay, you know, you're thinking, and that it's the process and iterations to get us to the final result. But I maintain that the desk that grows with your child, the reversible belt, your shoes that change, no.
The last two on my list that are cars that I do define them as cars of the 80s. They sit there alongside the DeLorean. One is the Pontiac Firebird with the fire chicken on the hood.
You had a great list.
Yeah, that's a crazy one. And
fire
also
chicken.
The Toyota Celica Supra, the boxy one.
Oh,
with,
that,
before
dang.
They split the two into a Celica and a Supra. It was the upper level Celica. The Toyota Celica Supra is an 80s masterpiece.
I totally forgot about that thing. Okay, I have to add the 87 roof yellow bird.
Because yeah, okay, there you go. You know, that's iconic.
The yellow bird was like, oh.
Yeah. Another car trying to kill you, but yet became an icon. Yes, for sure.
All right, moving on to the 90s. I think the 90s belongs to the Japanese.
Yes, I agree with you. There's others, but I agree with you. Just run the list. Let's go.
Here we go. Mazda Miata,
mm-hmm.
the Mazda RX-7, the FD, the Acura NSX,
yep.
the Integra Type R,
yep.
the Mitsubishi Lancer Evo 7, the Toyota Supra, the A80, and the Toyota Prius.
And the Nissan 300ZX.
And the 300ZX,
and the
of
Mitsubishi
course,
3000 GT.
Yeah,
we're still in Japan.
Good.
It's shocking. Oh, by the way, in 99, just under the wire, Honda S2000.
And the Honda, you're right.
The
90s
is an absolute Japanese throwdown. You know what else is in the 90s? I'm glad you brought up the Prius. Thank you. You know what else is in the 90s? The Nissan Maxima, the four-door sports car. The last time the Maxima
yes.
was a car we all wanted.
I wanted my parents to buy
was
one
in the
so
90s.
Bad. It said
absolutely.
4DSC.
4DS, yeah.
On the rear window. 4DSC. Four-door sports car.
I had
a sports car?
I had a teacher that just bought one in high school. She wasn't a car person, just bought one. And she talked about a couple times how great she thought the stereo was, and all the car guys in high school were like, are you kidding? The stereo? what are you talking about? What the stereo? But another thing out of the 90s that is influential because of everything it spawns after that, good and bad, the Lexus RX Egg.
Everything bad.
Isn't that the first time that somebody made... Because, look, Jeep had made something this shape before. Lots of other people made something kind of this rough shape before. But this is the first time that somebody builds a five-door, five-seat, hatchback, possibly lifted, is it an SUV thing, with no intention to go off-road. None. Zero.
Good point.
And this is what is the spawning piece, because it was wildly successful and very reliable. And it's one of the things, I mean, we all talk about the Lexus, the LS, also from this era, of being the thing that put Lexus on the map. But I would counter argue it's the RX. It's the egg. Because they sold so many. They got so many just dedicated fans of that vehicle. They're still selling it now. And an entire industry, or half of the industry, spawns kind of from that thinking. The Lexus freaking RX egg. There it is in the 1990s.
Dang.
I have non-Japanese cars on my list too.
Oh, you do?
Go. I do. I have a few. The Porsche Boxster is the 90s.
Okay. I've got originally. That in the 2000s, but
I see
okay.
It.
Yeah, yeah.
I see it. The McLaren F1. That is moonshot thinking if there ever was. McLaren, who had not made a street car, comes out of nowhere with Gordon Murray and goes, excuse us, let us show you how it's done. And then you can fight over it for the next two decades.
Although at a low level, Gordon Murray took the 1978 Brabham and incorporated fan technology from that Chaparral. And that
yes.
Also, the McLaren F1 is technically a fan car too.
McLaren F1's on here. Dodge Viper.
The Viper.
Mainly because especially if you see a picture of a first-gen Viper now, the only thought I think you're going to have is, they built that? It's just Dodge of all people.
True.
Built that. True. It looks like that. It does that. It has a truck engine. Who are you? What are you doing? And then another one that influences everything to come from the 90s, the Ford Explorer is out of the 90s.
All I think is the Firestone tire.
I know you do, but the Ford Explorer is Ford throwing down again the everyman car. We had the Model T. I wasn't looking for these trends, but we had the Model T in the 20s. The Mustang in the 60s, the Explorer in the 90s, all three of those cars, they couldn't make them fast enough, and it changes the landscape of the cars made around it. So the Explorer is the 90s.
Good.
I have one more, and that is the GM EV1.
Oh, excellent.
Was the 90s.
That's
a fully electric car.
That was 94.
That was, yeah. By the time we got to the year 2000, they'd crushed them all. This was a 90s car.
I know there's still one at CCS in Detroit, I think, unless GM's taken that back.
Well, no, the ones in museums will
museums,
continue.
They'll
it's
stick
just
around.
All yeah. The ones that were supposed to be driven, they gathered them all up and crushed them, apparently.
I would like to take a moment to take a mulligan and add the 65 Shelby Cobra and the 62 Ferrari GTO for the 60s.
I did have the GTO on my list. That's right.
I totally forgot those two.
Those are very good. Yeah.
See, there's things we're going to forget.
We're going to forget.
So many
good
ones.
You're all yelling at your device. I know you
like,
are. Thank you for yelling
with us.
What are
these idiots talking about? All right. Moving on to the aughts. The aughts belong to the Germans.
Okay.
This is the horsepower wars.
Okay.
I mean, the AMG everything. You know, I was sick the day that SL. There's so many SL55s out there. I see them constantly. They're
okay.
Just,
got it.
And they're cheap now. All right. So this is where I put the E46 BMW M3.
It's such an icon.
Icon.
And this is the M3 that BMW is still using. I mean, people
yeah,
like the
E30, yeah.
But when BMW is like, we make, this is stuff we've made in our past, they bring out the E46. That's the one
totally.
Under the lights. Yeah.
See, this is where I put the Boxster because the 987 Cayman and Boxster came out, and that's when the Cayman was introduced in
the I have the
aughts.
Cayman here, for sure.
Even
yep.
though the Boxster, you're right, it did yep. technically come out first, but because they're now the twins, the
yep,
pair,
I see it.
This is where mm-hmm. the where those go. And then two from Audi. The R8.
Good point.
The Audi R8. Everybody started saying the word side blade.
You're right.
Side blade. A side blade? What's a side blade? It's a side blade on this type of the side of the side blade.
Did you see the color on that side blade? I'm sorry. What was that sentence?
Side blade? A supercar from another supercar. And it was, I think of all R8s, that original R8 is the best looking. Everybody was like, the side blade is stupid. It's so cool now.
Yes,
the
I agree.
Side blade.
We all caught up to liking it. I agree with that for sure. Yeah.
And then, of course, the Audi TT, even though you could argue late 90s, but here is where it really took a hold
I see
of
that.
The public
I see
consciousness.
That. Yep.
And
yep.
that design influenced so many Fords of that era because Freeman Thomas joined Jay Mays at Ford and they started doing
mm-hmm.
that at Ford.
You're
so
right.
All the
That's
concepts at Ford started looking like TTs. My design for the late 90s looked like TT surfaces.
Huh.
The TT, so more German cars there. But the last on my list here is the 2005 Bugatti Veyron. That is obviously mm-hmm. a French manufacturer, but it's owned by Volkswagen, and this was their overture. Something that had 11 radiators, 11, to cool the thing, out of a quad turbo V16.
Mm-hmm.
Are you freaking
mm-hmm.
kidding
yeah,
me?
Yeah, I hear you. Icons out of the 2000s for me, many of them are tied to when cars that existed prior dropped in the U.S. and got even more popular. Okay. First one I'll mention, Lotus Elise. Technically a car from the 90s, believe it or
not.
That's
so crazy.
But first released in the U.S. in 2005. And that was unlike anything else being sold. I mean, put to the side my love for it and the fact that I own one. The Lotus Elise in 2005 is not like anything else being sold. And I'll use that by contrasting it with another car of the era, the Volkswagen Phaeton.
The
Okay.
Right.
These were sold in the same calendar year. The Lotus Elise and the Volkswagen Phaeton were sold at the same time.
It's
at the
true.
Same point in history.
Oh
you could
gosh.
Go and buy either one. And the Phaeton is on here kind of like your Bugatti Veyron. The Phaeton for me is iconic because it shows that any manufacturer can do whatever.
Yeah.
You don't have to stay in your lane anymore. It doesn't mean the Phaeton was successful because it wasn't. But my point is, think about Lexus kind of teases it already in the 90s with the LS, but the Phaeton puts a point on it and just goes, it doesn't matter what we've done before. Look at what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you've got Hyundai and Genesis and all these brands that spring up and try to shoot for the moon. The Veyron and the Phaeton are both of those. The WRX drops in the U.S. and everybody goes, what is this cool thing? Early 2000s.
That's a good
drops
point.
In the U.S. The 996 water-cooled 911. Technically, the end of the 90s.
True.
But this is the place where the talking point was the 911 is water cooled now. And we move from the 996 to the 997, the second water cooled generation of the 911. So this is, pardon the pun, the watershed decade for the 911.
Funny.
Or the water ad decade, I guess. This is the decade where they changed that fundamentally about the car. So I have to bring that up.
Chance pointed out that the 98 993... Between that car and the 99, between 1 year mm-hmm. of model sales, there's a $100,000 difference in 911s that are 98 to the 99 996.
That's astonishing.
It's like there's $100,000 just in difference generally across the board.
Two cars in the 2000s that I think represent peak nostalgia styling that then we started to turn away from it at that point. One is the Chrysler 300. Remember when the Chrysler 300 was in every possible movie, video?
Dang, yes.
It was just... And it was a Chrysler. It wasn't like we actually went and bought a Bentley, but that was the car with presence. The Chrysler 300, when it came out in the 2000s, was just like, have you seen this thing?
It's because Snoop gave it his blessing and
he
proclaimed
did.
That to be the new car. They turned it into the cheap Bentley at SEMA and everybody was doing that.
Similar. And also, I would say it is both the peak and thankfully the crash of the nostalgia era was the 2000s brought us the Chrysler PT Cruiser.
I thought of that and I left it off the list because just hate that thing.
It's
so
iconic,
much.
But it deserves its hate. The Honda Element.
Oh, good. Yes, good.
Nobody's done that since. And I think that's my note. The one last one, because it's gone away since, the Mitsubishi Eclipse.
Oh, Eclipse is so cool.
And it's gone.
I had a buddy that had one.
Yeah, it's gone.
Dang. All right. I think the 2010s belong to powertrains.
Okay.
Because here we start out with the 2012 Tesla Model S.
Yeah,
up against
on my list.
Hellcat everything.
You're totally right.
In this decade, we've
You're
got
right.
Voodoo engines in the Mustang, Hellcat all the cars, and yet the Model S is over here going, hello, I'm going to pretty much revolutionize the entire automotive industry. That's the 2010s to me.
That's very, very good. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting stuff. That's a great way to look at it. I do want to bring up the Jaguar F-Type, the closest Jaguar's gotten to the E-Type since they made the E-Type. Okay, 50 years prior. And I promise you can look up the press photos. When they launched the F-Type, there were many, many E-Types sitting around the press launch. They were trying so hard.
Look at our history.
Yeah, so cool. The F-Type is here. Yeah. The Alfa Giulia, specifically in quadrifoglio form, where has Alfa been?
Yeah, true. Hello,
that
we're back.
Drops in the 2010s. I mean, I know true. That the 4C was out there, but the Giulia was they had a Super Bowl ad. I mean, that was their big, have you noticed we're back car, which is fascinating. The 911 GT3 RS 4.0 is the 2010s.
The moment in time cars is my other category for the 2010s.
I have to bring that up because it's also the end of the Metzger engine. That engine, now they've actually rethink the engine. Toyota does two interesting things in the 10s. The LFA, that I'm going to say becomes the LC. The LC is the one you could buy. The LFA was look at what we can do. And the Lexus LC was now for the everyman.
Mm-hmm.
The Lexus LC is a sexy Lexus. Has that happened prior to that bit of styling? Was there ever a Lexus where you were like, have you seen how great that looks? Driving didn't come into the conversation. It's, if you will, it is their E-Type moment. where everybody goes, Lexus made that?
That's good.
So the LC is here. That. But then meanwhile, elsewhere at Toyota, they dropped the Scion FRS or the GT86, whatever you call it. I know it's a Subaru underneath, but let's be candid. Would never have existed without Toyota going, make this.
That's a great point.
So in the 2010s, we have the Lexus LC and the Toyota 86 FRS in the same decade, opposite ends of the spectrum. Both of them are like, we're all sitting around going, wait, the people that make the Prius and the Camry did those?
Great point. Well, I've got one. You just made me think of the Nissan GTR.
Yes, it's on my list.
We've shown no love to Skylines throughout, and they do deserve it, but because the R35 was really the first one you could get in the States, yep. It was truly that.
And it was the first YouTube car.
You're right.
It was the car that nobody could believe could beat everything.
And then it was like $70,000, $80,000. Yep. Everybody said, oh, it can do that at half the price or such a much lower price and have that performance. And it doesn't even need you. It's so powerful and fast.
One of the engineers made the point where he wanted his grandmother to be able to drive this car close to the speed of a professional racing driver. That was the premise.
So when you tell somebody like my grandma's faster than you, he's right.
He's right, especially if they drive a GTR. That's absolutely the case. Yeah, that car was a throwdown for sure. Lots of great stuff there. I have two others to mention. One was a never come again car from this manufacturer, and the other, same manufacturer, was too early to the game. BMW with the 1M, never coming again.
Yeah.
And too early with the i8.
I realize the Cadillac V-Series wagon with the V8 and the manual also transmission here. 2012.
Also here, yes.
That Cayman R that was so great. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 911 that you mentioned. The 2011, 2012, somewhere in there. It's almost like every car manufacturer had something pretty special in there.
Absolutely, yes.
That arena. Wrapping up with the 2020s. We're still in the middle of the decade here. However,
I just don't know. I'm curious to hear what you said because I feel like I can't make a call here yet.
The only thing I can say at this point, and it's not a good one, is the Cybertruck. Because of a styling, turn the industry on its ear
kind of
influence.
Okay, sure.
Because it's so absurd, whether you love it or hate it, that's all it does. You either love it or hate it.
Yeah, there is no more polarizing design on the planet right now.
I've not yet met anybody that's sort of like, fine, yeah, it's cool.
Whatever.
That is the coolest thing, and it's going to completely revolutionize the way car designers think of approaching cars, or it's the worst thing ever conceived and should be burned with fire. I think this is going to have some sort of influence. I can't quite tell yet. It's early.
Interesting. Okay.
I'm leaving that open.
All right.
But we've got a lot of refinement going on. Car manufacturers are currently exploring. They've flexed, and now they're pulling back and going, okay, what do people really want to buy? It's been SUVs for a long time, but then what's
we're supposed to be EVs, future? But those are piling up. What are we going to make?
Exactly. Yeah. What are we going to do now?
Interesting. All right. That's good stuff. I am unsurprised to see that covering a century worth of influential cars has taken up most of our hour. Not a whole lot of time for questions, but I do want to run to this one that Kurt Meyer actually asked on Facebook a little while back as a follow-up to one of our conversations about YouTube. He said, would we be up for a rat race collaboration where the two of us race a distance against another show like Throttle House or Smoking Tire or something like that for a grand prize? I don't know what you're actually envisioning, Kirk, but the concept I am all for.
What's the prize?
What's the race?
Yeah, what's the race?
What it sounds like is a, you know, cross country, not about speed, about navigation thing is it's what I'm reading in, but I don't know if that's right. That kind of thing would be fascinating.
We could put that series under Hooked on Driving, you know.
We could. There you go. We'd drive to all the race courses. We could make it happen.
Speaking of which, Hooked on Driving events this week on the West Coast is Thunderhill Raceway 3 Mile on Friday, April 26th, 2024. And then on the East Coast, don't forget Homestead Miami Speedway. That's a 2-day event, Saturday, April 27th and Sunday, April 28th, 2024. Register for both now at hookedondriving.com. Guys, thank you for all your questions. We really appreciate it. Send us your Topic Tuesdays. We're really enjoying these and your car debates. Looking forward to next time. Cheers, everyone.